I'll admit it, I have not seen it yet. Have not had the time to get out to the movie theater. Tell you the truth, there are a lot of movies I'd really rather see at this point. I'd like to see Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible 3 before I see The Da Vinci Code. And we're going to continue to talk about it, but sooner or later I will get into the theater. And it sounds like endure the 2.5 hours that feels like 3.5. At least that's what the reviewers are saying about Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code film, in spite of what is considered world-class directing and world-class acting. Maybe it's the material. Maybe it's people's expectations. Who knows? We're going to be talking about the Da Vinci Code movie here in the first half hour or so of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, and thanks for tuning us in. Pastor David Lewis joins us here in Studio A. We'll start a conversation with him in just a few minutes. If you have a question or a comment on the Da Vinci Code movie, if you've seen it and you want to pipe in with your review, feel free to do that. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. You can use the numbers or the email to post questions or comments as we talk about the Da Vinci Code movie here in the first 40 minutes of Issues, etc. Following this conversation, before we get to hour two, Dr. Andrew Steinman will be our guest. We're going to talk about Old Testament Saint Esther. Now, it's a biblical saint day. On this day, the church remembers Esther. What should we be remembering? We'll answer that question. Then, at 4:30, I was put on to this sermon via Jeff, the producer here at Issues, etc., from, Charles Lehman, who's a vicar at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. He's vicar there for just a few more weeks, I think. But he put us on to this great sermon. We're going to review it at 4:30 by a regular guest here on the program, Dr. David Adams, preaching on Ezekiel 34, beginning at verse 11. Fat sheep culling the herd. He even does a rather compelling impression of a sheep in the middle of this sermon. So you'll want to stay tuned for our sermon review. And then at 5:30, from 5:30 to 6, Pastor Walt Snyder joins us to talk about Emperor Constantine. It'll tie in nicely with our first hour's conversation. Yesterday, the church remembered this. Well, I don't even know if he's counted as a saint. I guess he is counted as a saint of sorts. We'll talk about Emperor Constantine. So much in the news and popular conversation in the last half hour of Issues, etc. Pastor David Lewis joins us here in Studio A. He's assistant professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He will be leading a public forum titled Post-Release Perspective on the Da Vinci Code tonight at 7 o'clock at Werner Auditorium here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. I'll tell you a little bit more about that a little bit later in our conversation. Pastor Lewis, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be here.
Okay, you've seen the Da Vinci Code film from the perspective of kind of take off your seminary professor hat and as a moviegoer. What's your initial reaction to the film?
Well, I have to admit first that I did not think a lot of the book, and I found the book to be have very clunky prose. The action tended to be interrupted where Brown would have a character have what I call a thought soliloquy for about a page and a half, where you just get the author or this character thinking about, you know, usually some theological topic that goes on for a page and a half. And that made the book very clunky. And so I guess I'd be one of those few viewers who actually found the film more enjoyable than the book simply because it didn't take as long to watch as it did to read.
Okay, so your impressions of the novel were not stellar. Many of the reviewers have said, look, we don't know what went wrong. Tom Hanks, maybe the directing, maybe the script, maybe it was just too long and we're tired of long movies. But they're saying this movie kind of drags and is difficult to follow. Was that your impression too?
I found the movie very easy to follow because I was familiar with the book. And also I went in knowing that I was going to be leading this post-release perspective tonight. I had my mind wide open the whole time, paying attention to every detail. I think that if I had not gone in with that attitude, I probably would have been a little bored. However, the film, I would agree with some of the reviews. Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune says that the problem with this is that Ron Howard treats the Da Vinci Code with a reverence that it does not deserve. And A.O. Scott, reviewing for the New York Times, mentions that if the movie had been made intentionally more campy, it would have been a better film. In other words, one problem is that Ron Howard is trying to treat this story with a sense of reverence, almost as if he was making a biblical. And that's, I think, where he goes wrong, because in a lot of ways the story is a pretty silly, ridiculous story. And it could be a lot of fun if it had been done like an intentionally in a campy style. And so one of the actors that most reviewers praise is Sir Ian McKellen, who plays Sir Lee Teabing. Mm-hmm. And they credit him with sort of giving the film that sense of camp. And so as long as he's on the screen, the film actually does sort of pick up. And then as soon as what happens to him in the film happens, then it kind of goes down. And it seems that Hanks is kind of coasting through most of the movie. I think he's been sort of unfairly ripped by a lot of the critics. I think he's just sort of Tom Hanks being Tom Hanks. I personally like Tom Hanks as an actor, so I had no trouble with him.
Who doesn't? I mean,
yeah. So I had no. I really think Tom Hanks has been unfairly ripped upon. But
so the film's just kind of general impression of the film as a film, as a story, as entertainment is that, like the novel, my impression of the novel was it took itself way too seriously, and it sounds like that's what happens in the film.
And the film takes itself way too seriously. There is one line that I think was meant to be a serious line, and this is the line that got a lot of laughter at Cannes, unintentional laughter. This may be a spoiler for the movie, but when Tom Hanks speaks to the person who is the descendant of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, he says, "You're the last remaining descendant of Jesus Christ." And it's supposed to be a serious line, but when he said that, I couldn't help but break out laughing. And in a sense, it was noting that this was meant to be serious, but it came off as being unintentionally funny. And I think that's where the audience at Cannes broke out in laughter as well. And so the book takes itself too seriously. The film treats the book with an undue reverence. I believe that Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune is right. And that's kind of where the movie falls, because it really, this is, you might say it's campy material, so if it had been made that way, it would have been a better film.
Here's the question in my mind. For the people who read the book and were kind of impressed with the page-turning nature of the book, many people thought it was, do you think that taking this story, this idea that Dan Brown cooked up, and bringing it to film will make the ideas that he puts forth in the film and in the book more or less credible with the general population?
And I would say there that it depends upon your point of view going into the film. If you were someone who read Dan Brown's novel and you believed that he was making a good point, in other words, you assume that his point of view was a good point of view, namely that we don't really know the true story of Jesus and that the church has actually been suppressing a lot of the truth about Jesus, then you might go into the film and simply have your assumptions verified by the film. If you don't believe that, if you reject Brown's premise and you believe that the four Gospels are a faithful account of the life and ministry of Jesus Christ and that the church has been, you know, more or less proclaiming faithfully the gospel, and you're going to go in with your guard up, if the book didn't win you over, this movie certainly won't win you over. And then my impression for the people in the middle, there's always the chance that this film could move someone to adjust their belief system. However, A.O. Scott, in his review for the New York Times, makes a point that the movie is so boring that he doesn't think it's going to really shift anybody's point of view one way or the other. It's such a clunker. It's so slow. By the time you really get to the point where kind of Dan Brown's theology is being discussed, you're already too late into the film. And I was looking around at that point to notice that a lot of people were almost dozing off in their seats.
That's not good. That's never good, no matter what kind of a movie you're making. Let's talk about Dan Brown's theology. Many people who have reviewed the movie have, more from a content standpoint, have noted that, or at least asserted that, the movie tones down Brown's assertions, or it tends to kind of not assert them so strongly as Dan Brown does in the book. Is that your impression?
Yeah, that is my impression. And I wonder if director Ron Howard was perhaps intentionally trying to balance things to make this story more compatible with an American audience, especially knowing that there's going to be a lot of evangelical Christians in this American audience. And if he was trying to balance the story somewhat, lighten Brown's theology just a bit to maybe make it a little more compatible with the American, perhaps Christian evangelical audience that might be attending this film. And then there's also the possibility, suggested by one of my colleagues, that maybe Brown was aware that some of the things that he asserts in the book were not true. And so maybe he used his influence to have some of those things maybe change just a little bit to again, make his film more compatible with the people who may be coming to view it.
Before we came on there, you mentioned an example of that, and that is the whole point where the exposition of Dan Brown's theory, really, is made in the film through the voice of this historian, Tiebing, where he's explaining Constantine's role in kind of shaping the future of Christianity and whether Jesus was considered divine or not before the Council of Nicaea. You said there's something in the film that isn't in the book. What is it?
Yes. This is kind of one of the important places in the film where they kind of change the book. And the words that are put into the mouth of this character, Tiebing, are actually the thoughts of Robert Langdon, the character played by Tom Hanks, in the book. And if you were to look at the book, page 124 through 125, Langdon has these thoughts while he's still in the museum, before he and the character Sophie Nauvoo have set out, you know, in pursuit of the Keystone. But in the movie, of course, you don't see an exposition of Tom Hanks' thoughts. These words are almost word for word put into the mouth of Tiebing at his chateau. And this is the place where, in the book, Dan Brown sort of discusses his theology, this view that Christianity has suppressed the divine feminine. And this is why Mary Magdalene was persecuted first by the male apostles, and then later slandered by the church. And then Constantine conveys the Council of Nicaea, and this is where the divine feminine begins to be suppressed, where the Bible, the New Testament, is canonized, so all the Gnostic Gospels are suppressed, and where anybody who believes that Jesus was only a human is suppressed. And Dan Brown in the book seems to indicate that before Constantine, most Christians thought Jesus was human, simply a human, a prophet of God. And so at this point, this is where the director and the author of the screenplay tweak Dan Brown a bit. Because when Tiebing makes the point that Jesus was not divine until the Council of Nicaea, Tom Hanks comes in arguing, no, that's not true. There were many people before Nicaea who did believe that Jesus was divine. And so what we get instead is this kind of pre-Nicaea pluralism among the Christians, where you have some Christians who believe Jesus was simply a man who was a prophet of God. You have other Christians who believe that he was divine. This is where the movie is a little more favorable to orthodoxy than the book is. And then what happens at Nicaea is that one side wins, and then the church begins to suppress all those who say that Jesus was simply a man.
You see, what concerns me about that is not only, and we can discuss this here at length, how untrue that is as a matter of history.
Yes.
But it's a mitigation of what Dan Brown asserts in the book. And the people might have read the book and said, okay, come on.
Right.
But if they see that in the film, especially ignorant of what Dan Brown asserted in the book, they might say, well, now that sounds plausible. There are all sorts of political infighting in the church. There always has been. And maybe the divinity of Jesus is just the result of a political warfare where Constantine won.
Yes. And I went to see this with a number of my colleagues. And when we left the theater, we were actually discussing how there is evidence that Ron Howard, I think, was probably trying to tweak the film to make it more compatible with an American evangelical Christian viewing audience. Maybe that's what made him tweak the story, maybe not. That's my assumption, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I believe that actually the changes that are in the film actually are more theologically dangerous than the original book itself. There's that point where, again, we live in a pluralistic society, and so I think a lot of this is us reading our pluralism back into the early centuries of Christianity to say, well, just like we have all this diversity in theology today, even back then it was the same way, and then it's the oppressive institutional church that's kind of hammering one point of view. At the end of the film, another tweak that's not in the book, Tom Hanks is speaking to the character who has just discovered that she's the heir of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And she asks, what should she do now? Should she reveal who she is and so upset the foundation of Christianity? And Tom Hanks' response is sort of a what would Jesus do? Jesus would encourage faith. He wouldn't destroy faith. And then Tom Hanks says, you know, whether Jesus was divine or human does not matter so much. He was an extraordinary man. And he's kind of the key to the divine within all of us. And so it becomes sort of a faith is important. And it's not so much faith in something, just that you have faith. In other words, the actual distinctions of doctrine are not so key as the fact that you believe in God. And so she's encouraged, in a sense, to keep her anonymity and not reveal herself because that would mess with a lot of people's faith. But it's not that the church is right. It's just that people believe what they believe and that whatever they believe is true. And so you actually get kind of a pluralistic, kind of postmodern tweak of Dan Brown's novel. Now, the reason I believe this is actually more dangerous is, as you said, the novel is kind of this promotion of the divine feminine. You know, the story ends with Langdon worshiping where he thinks the body of Mary Magdalene is in reverence to the divine feminine. And so Dan Brown, in a sense, I think, is trying to reassert the divine feminine in religious faith and piety. And that's basically, a lot of Christians would say, well, that's pagan. However, when you come and say, well, you know, it's important that you have faith and that you have faith in God, and your faith is important, but that you believe in God is a big deal, that you believe in Jesus is a big deal, but what exactly you believe about God and Jesus, that's not so important. And I think this is a religious thought pattern that is of greater danger to evangelical Christians, because they would say, well, if this person believes in Jesus but doesn't think that he's God, doesn't think he died for sin, doesn't think he rose from the dead, well, why worry about those doctrinal distinctions there, as long as they believe in Jesus, who was an extraordinary man? And that ends up being the final message of the film, which is different than the book, and I think in a lot of ways more challenging and even more spiritually dangerous than the book.
We're talking with Pastor David Lewis. He's assistant professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He's going to be leading a public forum titled Post-Release Perspective on the Da Vinci Code tonight at 7 o'clock at Werner Auditorium here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Now, just a moment here on this, on the post-release perspective of the Da Vinci Code. What can people expect if they come out tonight?
Well, first I'm going to cover some of the points that were made in the panel discussion last week.
With the faculty members.
With the faculty members. Mm-hmm. Including some of the historical facts that debunk Brown's theory, including the fact that the four Gospels were already bound together in a single codex and read and used by the church as scripture by 150 AD, probably earlier than that, while the Gnostic Gospels weren't written until after 150, which debunks his idea that the four Gospels really weren't seen as New Testament until Nicaea in 325. And then the point that Jesus was worshipped as God already in the New Testament days, as evidenced in Philippians chapter 2, the hymn sung to Jesus that Paul quotes. I'm going to review those points. Then I'm going to go through some of the movie reviews of The Da Vinci Code and then advise people whether you should see this just as a good movie or not, and probably tell them better to save your money, wait till it comes out on DVD, or go see National Treasure, which is a better film with a similar theme. And then I'm going to talk some about how we should watch a film. In other words, I think this is, watching a movie, something people don't think about, but I'm actually going to kind of share some of my ideas about how you actually watch a film, what you should be thinking about, why you couldn't just say The Da Vinci Code is just a movie, why take it so seriously. Well, it's a little more than just a movie. In a sense, every movie is more than just a movie. We're going to talk about that, and then I'm going to go through some of the theological points that are made in both the book and the film, and then finally conclude with this, you know, what we just talked about, where the film actually moves away from the book in a direction that I think some people think is less offensive, but as I said earlier, I think is actually a little more spiritually challenging. This idea that the film isn't about the divine feminine as much as it is about the importance of individual faith, and that the actual doctrinal distinctions don't matter so much as long as you just believe whatever you believe.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Talking with Pastor David Lewis about the Da Vinci Code movie. Our in-studio email address, issues@kfuo.org. Our conversation will continue here on the other side of the break. Before we get to that break, it sounds as though the default position in the film that someone will walk away with is Jesus, a good guy. Who really knows what people believed about him, and who really knows whether this is all true? In the end, does it really matter? Is that kind of the general impression someone might walk away with? That's an interesting alternative theory about Jesus, but it doesn't really matter if it's true or false.
Yes, I think that's why I believe this is the message of the film in a lot of ways is more challenging and more spiritually dangerous, because Dan Brown's novel at least, you know, takes a stand. You know, Jesus was human. He did marry Mary Magdalene, and he did father a child through her, and that the bloodline of Christ continues. All of that is in the movie and remains unchallenged, as if that is all historical fact. What's left open is the fact about whether Jesus was truly human or truly divine. And in a, and it's kind of left open probably for the Christian audience. Yeah, you guys can believe that he's truly divine. But I would say to that viewer who is not watching the movie with, you might say, with his mind open, kind of critically thinking about what's coming at him, he might walk away with the idea that, yeah, the early church, there was a lot of plurality about what was believed about Jesus. And now we live in a time where there's a lot of plurality in what people believe about Jesus. And as long as you believe something and it kind of reassures somebody and helps them live through life, that's good. But in a sense, there is no definite thing we can know about Jesus, except with the film that he married Mary Magdalene and had a daughter, which, of course, there's no evidence in any of the four Gospels.
How does the church come across in this film? Of course, the movie opens with the now famous scene of a man murdered in the Louvre. We come to learn later that the murder probably comes, it takes place at the hands of some agent of the church through Opus Dei.
Right.
How does the church come across?
The church does not come across very favorably, and that's not surprising. I think there's a trend in a lot of popular films to display the institutional church as either kind of ineptly benign or somehow evil. And now it's only Opus Dei that's targeted in the book and in the film, but basically you've got an albino monk who murders the curator of the museum, who later murders a nun, who's out to murder the main characters. He whips himself to chastise himself, and this is shown several times brutally. And so you get this idea that, of course, this man is probably a religious fanatic, very deranged. And then you get the bishop for which this character Silas, the monk assassin, is working for. The bishop is played by Alfred Molina, who also played John Tetzel in the Luther movie. and Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2. But Alfred Molina, of course, is motivated by getting money to make his group, Opus Dei, a more powerful segment of the Roman Catholic Church. And so you get this monk assassin who beats himself and then goes around murdering people in the name of Jesus. And then you get this kind of chubby monk who's the power over him, who's basically out to get money and to strengthen his own power position within the church. So, no, the institutional church does not come off very well in the film or in the book.
When we come back from this break, I want to pursue that a little bit, because if there has been one, in advance of the release of the film, The Da Vinci Code, if there's been one fact that circulated in the news that has kind of got people saying, okay, Dan Brown got this one so wrong, it couldn't be, maybe he got so many other things wrong, is the issue of Opus Dei. This organization that, according to Dan Brown, is quite sinister, quite ancient, and just really almost the assassin CIA of the Vatican. And then we have interviews with their representatives. Turns out they have no monks. They're mostly a lay organization. They're actually really, really harmless, at least in terms of what their goals are, and not as powerful, not nearly as powerful or as sinister as Dan Brown makes them out to be. We'll talk about that and then get into how to watch this movie and whether or not a Christian who has an interest in history, an interest in the claims made by Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, should see the film. Our call-in numbers, call during this break, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
There is nothing like the relationship between a mother and her child. Nothing. And that relationship is only surpassed by the relationship between our Heavenly Father and His children in Jesus Christ. These two themes, our earthly mothers and our Heavenly Father, are brought together in a beautifully illustrated children's book. It's our Issues Etc. book of the month for April. It's called Mommy Promises by Issues Etc. regular guest Julie Stiegelmeyer. Mommy Promises is available from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy and find the book at our website, issuesetc.org. Mommy Promises is right there on the homepage, issuesetc.org. It's the Issues Etc. book of the month for April, Mommy Promises by Issues Etc. regular guest Julie Stiegelmeyer, 1-800-325-3040.
Susan B. Anthony was an outspoken opponent of abortion. So were many of her colleagues.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Alice Paul was an early feminist and the author of the original Equal Rights Amendment. Among her famous quotes is the following: "Abortion is the ultimate exploitation of women." At the Susan B. Anthony List, we are proud to call to mind the early feminist opposition to abortion, what Anthony herself called the horrible crime of child murder. Our goals are to train pro-life activists, advocate the passage of pro-life legislation, and increase the percentage of pro-life women in Congress. Help us carry on the pro-life legacy. Find out more about the Susan B. Anthony List.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. John Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, told graduates of Georgetown University Law School on Sunday that he desires more consensus in court opinions and fewer 5-4 controversial decisions. His most famous predecessor was John Marshall. The Marshall Court almost always offered unanimous decisions. Marshall said a decision must be so modified as to receive the approbation of all before it can be delivered as the opinion of all. Now, the two justices reflect a deep-seated truth about human nature, that we don't like to be told what to do, whether it's one of God's commandments or something handed down by a legislature or court. We hear, "Thou shalt," or "Thou shalt not," and our sinful nature says, "Oh, yes, I will." St. Paul taught it this way: law brings wrath. Where there is no law, there is no transgressions. Romans 4:15. That's why 5-4 decisions are guaranteed to be more controversial than unanimous or nearly unanimous opinions. Think about that next time you're facing a hard decision with family or coworkers. Robert said, "Division should not be artificially suppressed, but the rule of law benefits from a broader agreement." And Jesus says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God." I'm Dale Meyer.
The National Park Service announces that the Ulysses S. Grant National Historic Site will present an exhibit of civilian clothing from the Civil War era. It's the private collection from Philip and Janine Whiteman. The exhibit will run June 1st through 4th. The site is located at 7400 Grant Road. That's in South St. Louis County, and this will be open daily from 9 until 5. The Whiteman's collection of historic Civil War clothing stems from their involvement in Civil War reenacting, and this resulted in a fine collection of Civil War vintage clothing.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. For about the next 10 or 15 minutes, we'll be talking with Pastor David Lewis, continuing our conversation on the Da Vinci Code movie. We want to hear from you, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. At about 3:50 or so, we'll pick up our conversation with Dr. Andrew Steinman of Concordia University in River Forest, Illinois. Talk about the church remembering today an Old Testament saint, Esther, and get her story. And then at 5:30, at 4:30, we'll be reviewing a sermon by one of Pastor Lewis's colleagues, Dr. David Adams. He preached it in the chapel of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Very interesting sermon from Ezekiel chapter 34. And in the last half hour, we'll talk about Constantine, Emperor Constantine. Pastor Walt Snyder will be our guest. Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Talk first with Dan, who is listening on the Internet in Southern California. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well.
Nice to be talking to you and Pastor Lewis. And Pastor, we have a little bit of a connection here. You may not realize that went through lay ministry training with your father.
Oh, my dad, Howard Lewis?
Yes.
Okay.
So he talked quite a lot about you and spoke well of you. So
good to hear that.
Yeah. The point I like to make is a lot of people in my parish come up to me and ask me, should we read this book? Should we watch the movie? And the dangers that I like to tell them they have to look out for is, let's say, for instance, I wrote a book about your family. And in this book, now it's fiction, and on the cover I will even put it that it's a novel. And in this book I'm going to write about your father is going to be an alcoholic and a child molester, and your mother is having an affair. Now, mind you, it's just a novel. It's all fiction. It's made up. And you know that it's made up. But unfortunately, people reading that book may not realize that. And I think that's the danger that we have here is that we live in a biblically illiterate society where people are reading these mistruths and they're going to take them as not being fiction, but as nonfiction and the truth.
All right. Thank you very much, Dan. Thanks for listening out there in Southern California. Do you think that given the obvious biblical illiteracy, not only in the general population, but even among many church-going Christians, that that is a pretty fair scenario of this book and of the film?
Yes, I think Dan has made an excellent point there. Dr. Paul Robinson, in the panel discussion last week, made a point that often historical misinformation becomes the conventional wisdom. And he cited, for example, George Washington cutting down the cherry tree. Everybody believes that's true, but it never happened. That's kind of an innocent example. And so he said history does matter. And one of the points he made in the panel discussion last week is that a lot of people who do not know history, who do not know the Bible, who do not know church history, who've never read the four canonical gospels, let alone the Gnostic gospels, may read the book and watch the movie and come away with the idea that, oh, this is true. What Dan said, for instance, about, you know, writing a family history and, you know, tweaking things to make it interesting. You have an alcoholic father, you got a mother who's an adulteress. Well, if these are real people, that would be slander. You're lying about these people. You're violating the Eighth Commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. And so on that hand, it's actually sinful. But you could say, well, it's just a movie, it's just a novel, it's just entertainment. What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is that people may view that film, read that book, and come away believing that the historical misinformation is actually the truth. And then what happens is something that is not true becomes conventional wisdom. And we've actually seen this in various recent films about past events that basically reinterpret the past. You can think of Disney's Pocahontas, where rather than Pocahontas converting to Christianity, as actually happened, she remains this kind of pagan nature worshiper. Kids view that movie, and you know, my son viewed that, and he said, oh, well, Pocahontas never became a Christian. I saw the Disney movie, and I said, well, son, no, she did become a Christian. The Disney movie is giving you a false account of what actually happened. And they're doing it to push forward a story, and, of course, that story's got a meaning. And it's really that meaning that, you know, some of these stories are trying to push, which is why I believe you can't really just say it's a movie. I call that this is a term I made up, the myth of the neutrality of the entertainment experience, that somehow you can get away with anything if it's all done for the sake of entertaining, even if I change history or lie about somebody. As long as it's just to entertain people, it's okay. No, because that misinformation often can become a part of conventional wisdom.
Let's talk with Betty, who's calling from Lake St. Louis. Betty, thanks for waiting, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, yes, you've kind of covered what I wanted to say. I can't understand why a Christian would want to see this film, because they surely can't say it's for entertainment reasons to see the denial of Jesus Christ's divinity. You know, I can understand church leaders having to see the film so they can, you know, hold discussions such as yours. But I really find it somewhat discouraging that the church is not more adamant about not Christians not supporting the book and film. Seems to me that they're kind of wimpy about it.
Betty, thank you for the call. Your thoughts on this, because this comes up every time. We've been discussing the book for 2 years, and we've been discussing the film since it was announced that it was going to be made, asking people should they see it, should they not see it. How would you respond to that question?
Well, I'll show some solidarity with the panel discussion from last Tuesday, where they kind of left it open. Christians could boycott the film, which could be a faithful response. Christians could view the film for the sake of knowing what it contains, so they can then talk more intelligently with their non-Christian friends about this film and then point out the inaccuracies. And so I would not have seen the film if I had not been asked to do this post-viewing perspective, post-release perspective. I probably would have skipped the film. And if I wanted to see Ian McKellen, I would have waited for X-Men 3, which is coming out this Friday.
Looking forward to that one.
Yeah, but at the same time, I believe that a Christian could view this film in the right spirit. But what I would warn is that you need to be aware of where this film deviates, you know, from what the Gospels say about Jesus Christ. There's no information in the canonical Gospels that Jesus married Mary Magdalene and fathered a daughter through her. I mean, that's the speculation, which is being presented as history, which then can become, you know, misinformation then can become part of the conventional wisdom of some of the viewers. And my thoughts would be I would not advise Christians to see this film first because I don't think it's a good movie. So if you're going to spend money on a film, wait for one that actually is going to be entertaining. And second, because of its anti-Christian message, you know, don't spend the $7 to $10. If you have to watch it, wait till it comes out on DVD and then watch it with other Christians where you can actually pick out the bad theology, maybe in a Bible study situation.
You know, I'm picturing people sitting with this and watching the DVD, and that could turn into, logistically, could turn into an entire night, an entire day, if you have to stop it every time you make a correction, especially with a movie that seems that long already. People might by that time just say, okay, enough of Dan Brown and his film. Let's see what Jerry has to say, calling from South County. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, hi, Todd, and hi to your guest. So could you then say, except for the film reviewers, pastors, Christian evangelists, teachers that we hear on the radio, could one then consider that seeing movies that misrepresent Jesus Christ as a sin because of its blasphemy or for any other reason, it truly is a sin, since we know the gist of these stories, most people do before they decide to go see them.
All right, Jerry, thank you very much. Would you go so far as to say that unless you have to see the film is a sin?
I wouldn't go that far. Again, to speak with the panel from last Tuesday, a Christian might go to see this movie simply so they can discuss it intelligently with their neighbors, their friends, their coworkers, especially those who are not Christians, so then they could better represent a good, solid Christian response to what the movie says. If there's any sin, the sin would lie with those who've produced and written this story. Dan Brown's novel does very much, you know, take on the Orthodox view of who Jesus is. And this was the big question asked by the panel last week. Did Jesus rise from the dead? If he did rise, then who he is, it becomes a very serious thing. But if he didn't rise, then it's not. And, of course, the Orthodox position is confessing with the apostles, and as the church has always said, that he rose from the dead. And that signifies that he is indeed the Son of God, God who became man, who came to save us from sin and death. And so this becomes a Jesus we can boldly proclaim, that we can share with our friends and neighbors who don't believe in Jesus. And the novel and the film would attack those basic assumptions. In fact, Gnosticism had a completely different worldview than Orthodox Christianity. Everything Christianity said about God and Jesus, they denied. And these are kind of the two worldviews that are held in opposition, both in Dan Brown's book, and I believe there's a resurgence of Gnosticism today. And so I wouldn't say it's a sin to go see the movie, but I would say if you go see the movie, go in thinking critically and knowing what you believe. Again, I would say as an entertainment experience, it's not worth seeing. And then I would warn, just because of the bad theology, it's not worth checking out either.
Let's talk about the Gnosticism a little bit, because in the film, does the word Gnostic or Gnostic Gospels get used?
No,
recollection?
The word Gnostic is not used. However, Teeming, in that one scene where he discusses his point of view, he mentions the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Mary, both of which are Gnostic Gospels. So the word Gnostic is not used, but we actually get a hint of Gnosticism toward the end of the film, when the character played by Tom Hanks is speaking with the character Sophie Nouveau, and he's speaking about Jesus, how it doesn't matter so much if you believe he was divine or human. He was an extraordinary man. And then he makes the slight reference that he's kind of the key to discovering the divine within all of us, which is a very Gnostic way of thinking, this idea that everybody's got a spark of the divine within them. It's kind of an American Gnosticism. You know, the point of Gnosticism in the early centuries was we wanted to escape this fleshly existence. And now in the United States today, Gnosticism is actually often used as kind of a self-empowerment tool. Like, you know, you got faith, you got a spark of the divine, you can have a really cool life. And so you find a lot of this New Age kind of Gnostic stuff in business seminars and the like.
Dan Brown seems to have much of the success of the novel, of the idea that the book promulgates, and perhaps even of the film, is surrounded by, he's got a kind of small cadre of scholars that he goes to, kind of the Elaine Pagels types,
right,
the Bajans,
right,
and those who've written Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Yes.
And who have played upon what Dan Brown did, was took what they kind of said, well, here are these are quote-unquote alternate gospels, and Dan Brown has played upon the general ignorance of people to say they've been hidden from you.
Yes.
They've been kept from you. Is that in fact true? Has the Gospel of Judas, Mary, Thomas, have they been kept from the general public by the church?
No. They died out because Gnosticism died out. It's not because the church necessarily suppressed them, because the church really was not legal until after Emperor Constantine, and yet you have the decline of Gnosticism before then, because you might say in the theological debates, there wasn't actually killing going on. The creedal Christianity, Orthodoxy, won, and so these Gospels fell out of use simply because, you might say, most Christians realized they weren't true. And I would repeat what Professor Jeff Cloas, I think, said on the air here, and what he said in the panel last week, is we're not trying to hide these from you. You can go get them, read them for yourself, and when you read these Gnostic Gospels, you'll see how silly and ridiculous a lot of what they say are. In fact, I think one of the best things you could do is actually read the Gospel of Mary, read the Gospel of Philip, and you'll get do that, of course, knowing the four Gospels as well, and you'll get a sense about how the content of these Gospels is so out of whack with what we confess in the creeds and what the four Gospels proclaim about Jesus.
Gail is listening in St. Charles. Gail, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I did see the movie. I'm a Christian. I did see the movie, and I had a question about the ending with the Sophie character. I don't understand the saying that she is the last descendant of Christ, and I don't understand assigning any divinity to her, because there would have been over 2,000 years this line coming down, and we don't have any record of any divinity through that line, do we?
All right. Thank you very much, Gail. That puzzled me, too. First of all, Dan Brown says Jesus wasn't divine, but somehow his descendants are divine. And then how does the film make any attempt to kind of trace this divinity within this supposed line of Jesus' descendants?
I'd have to see the movie again, which I don't plan to do.
Okay.
But maybe when it comes out on DVD in a Bible study experience. But I don't know if they're claiming so much that his descendants are divine, but necessarily that they're somehow the royal messianic line of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And, you know, the movie makes the point that Mary Magdalene, after Jesus died, she's pregnant with his daughter. Because she's a woman, she's rejected by the male apostles who found the church, and so she goes to France where she gives birth, and so the bloodline of Christ continues in France, and Sophie Nouveau is the last descendant of Jesus. The divinity seems to be more this Gnostic idea, not so much that they're divine, but the message of Jesus is that there's kind of the divine within all of us. You know, this, I call it American Gnosticism, because the goal of American Gnosticism isn't so much to escape the fleshly existence, but sort of to have a really, what I'd say, a really cool life, because everybody's got a spark of divinity. Now, it is interesting how they show her as being the Christ character, with a couple of things that I don't think are in the book. For instance, she helps out a junkie, and then she cures Tom Hanks of his claustrophobia in the one miracle sequence in the movie. And later he recalls these things when he's talking to her about her identity. But then it's kind of interesting. I think it's intended as a joke. She tries to walk on water. She steps her foot on this little puddle, but of course she can't. And in a lot of ways, I think that kind of shoots down the whole movie, that in fact these, you know, you recognize these people for being nothing other than a bunch of other fallen human sinners who actually need Jesus as their savior.
This is Lisa. She's calling from Texas. Lisa, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I haven't seen the movie, have no intention to, but isn't the character Sophie Nouveau, doesn't her name mean new wisdom? And isn't it ironic that she's dumber than dirt?
Thank you, Lisa. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's one of Dan Brown's gimmicks, is Sophie Nouveau means the new wisdom. The tie-in would be the Greek word for wisdom, Sophia. Is often, you know, the gender is feminine, and often then that's personified as a woman, you know, the goddess of wisdom. And so Sophie Nouveau actually represents, this is very important in Dan Brown's novel, she represents the sacred feminine. And as a representative of the sacred feminine, you know, she calls back the era when the goddess was worshipped along with the god. And, of course, Christianity after Constantine suppresses the feminine and only has a male deity. And Mary Magdalene, of course, represents the sacred feminine in her relationship with Jesus. And then Sophie Nouveau is kind of the continuation of that. So notice there is no male descendant of Jesus in the novel or in the film. It becomes Sophie Nouveau, the new wisdom. Now, is she dumber than dirt? In the book, a lot is made of the fact that she's a very intelligent person. You know, she's a cryptologist. She can figure out codes. The only thing she doesn't know is her identity. That's the ignorance that you might say the point of the story is for her to really discover who she is. So is she dumber than dirt? I don't think it's the intent of the novel or the film to do that. Now, whether the actress Audrey Tautou, however you pronounce that, whether she... You know, there's mixed reviews about her. Some people just see her kind of like a deer caught in the headlights throughout the whole movie, just running around not knowing anything. And other critics are a little more favorable of her acting in this film. But I don't think that was the intention of the book or the movie.
As to the truth that Dan Brown worked so hard in the book and the film he works very hard to give us an alternative.
Yes.
To the truth. Is there any question that Jesus was aware of his own divinity? A lot of Christians even kind of believe the conventional wisdom. Well, Jesus never really said he was God. They buy into that kind of thing. Is there any question in the New Testament as to whether or not Jesus not only asserts his divinity, is fully aware of who he is and what he has come to do?
I would say all four canonical Gospels present Jesus as someone who is aware of who he is and why he came. The Gospel of Mark is often seen as the most primitive of the Gospels. I don't actually believe that, but even in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is he bears an authority which comes from him being the Son of God. In all four Gospels, Jesus is the Son of God, and he's aware of who he is and why he's here. And so I don't think it's a fair reading of the four canonical Gospels to say Jesus was unaware of who he was, and he was sort of on this journey of self-discovery that we find the character Sophie Nouveau in the movie is on. Jesus was fully aware of who he was, why he was here, and where his life and ministry would conclude with passion, crucifixion, death, and resurrection. All four Gospels make it very clear that Jesus knew who he was and why he was here.
And as to the place or the role given to women among Jesus' disciples or by the early church, how would you correct Dan Brown's assertion that the early church, from its very inception, even when it was merely the gathering of the apostles, were determined to suppress, quote-unquote, the divine feminine, Mary Magdalene as person, and women in general? How would you respond to that?
I would argue, on the contrary, that the Gospels and the Epistles represent, in a lot of ways, a very revolutionary idea about women and their position within Christianity and within the church. The mere fact that the four Gospels are honest, that it's the women who remain faithful to Jesus through his crucifixion, it's the women who come to the tomb and the women who see him resurrected first. If it was indeed that, you know, the male authors of the four canonical Gospels tried to suppress the feminine, then why do they not have Peter and John being faithful all the way to the end, even through the crucifixion, and then them discovering the empty tomb first and seeing Jesus risen first? I mean, just the way the story is described in the four Gospels shows a prominence that the women had. The Gospel of Luke proclaims the role that the women had in a lot of ways as kind of those who funded Jesus' ministry. And, you know, Paul mentions Priscilla along with her husband Aquila as a partner in the ministry, not just Aquila. He mentions the wife, and often her name is mentioned first. And so Dan Brown's claim that, you know, from the earliest days, the church was trying to suppress the divine feminine or in the role of women just doesn't read well with the Gospels and the Epistles. My opinion is that you go to Galatians chapter 3, in all who've been baptized into Christ Jesus have put on Christ. There's no longer Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. That's actually a very revolutionary thought in the first century AD.
What's the opportunity here? Big blockbuster book, 60 million sold nationwide. I mean, worldwide. Film opens United States, Europe. It's making a lot of money, of course, not being favorably reviewed by the critics. But laying that aside, what is the opportunity here laid before us by the Da Vinci Code?
I would say whether you see the film or whether you don't see the film, whether you read the book or whether you don't read the book, there's plenty of information out there about what the book says about Jesus and what the film is saying about Jesus. And the opportunity for us is to engage in dialogue with our friends, our neighbors, our family members. Some of these may be Christians who don't know, and they may have questions, and I think we should be ready with a response to them. And there may be those who do not believe in Jesus, and this could give us an opportunity to confess who Jesus is, that he was, in fact, the Son of God, who did not come to be married and found this bloodline, but who actually came to shed his blood on the cross for mankind and womankind and to save us from sin, and who bodily rose from the dead, that we've got an opportunity to confess what we confess in the creeds every Sunday to those who may have questions about who Jesus is. And so I'd say the big opportunity is for us to look for those opportunities as this movie is being discussed among our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, to become a part of that conversation and then to confess what we as Christians have always confessed about the true nature of Jesus Christ and what he's done for us.
Then finally, with only a minute here, storytelling and film is a compelling means of communication.
Yes, it is.
Just as a story, if Dan Brown simply wanted to get across the ideas of his book in a compelling way that truly communicates and kind of convinces and persuades, do you think the Da Vinci film, as a story, succeeds or fails?
Well, for me personally, it fails, but I've got presuppositions going in. I'm a confessing, believing Christian. I would like to say that the novel's a clunker and the film is too long and that they failed, but the fact that the novel is a bestseller and that the movie has made $77 million here in the United States shows that it has been effective with some people, and therefore his story in a lot of ways has been influential in how people think about Jesus, which is why we should be ready to respond to him.
Pastor David Lewis is Assistant Professor of New Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. He is going to be leading a public forum that's tonight at 7 o'clock at Warner Auditorium right here on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. As you come onto the campus, just follow the signs to Warner Auditorium or stop and ask one of those kind seminarians wondering about aimlessly where the auditorium is. They'll point you to the post-release perspective on the Da Vinci Code being led tonight by Pastor David Lewis. Thanks for coming in and being our guest in the first hour.
You're very welcome. Good to be here.
When we come back from this break, we will either be reviewing a sermon by Dr. David Adams, or if we're able to get a hold of him, we're going to be talking with Dr. Andrew Steinman about an Old Testament saint, Esther. Talk about women in the Bible. Here's one. Dr. Steinman, Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University in River Forest, Illinois, right after this break. I'm Todd Wilkins. Stay tuned. Hour two of Issues, Etc. straight ahead.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.